Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. So here's a question for us to muse about a little bit. We've been talking about all kinds of things together already. If you're listening to this on the podcast or later online, I mean, I would cherish for everyone who joins us online to be able to be in the room because it is a different experience. But so we've been talking about all kinds of things together already, so maybe this is an extension for those of us in the room of that spirit and of engagement with one another, but some questions to help us get this particular exploration underway. So I'm going to give us two questions, and then we can take a moment to talk about them, and then we'll go on. So the first question is, and this requires a little reflection, when you were growing up, can you remember what you were taught, either implicitly or explicitly, about the relationship between work and rest? Or sort of on a related note, what do you recall learning about the value of play? So when you look back, like we've done some of that already this morning, or looking back on our lives and going, if this event had been different, what would the ripples have been? Look back. Just think for a moment about those two things. What were you taught about the relationship between work and rest, or what do you recall learning about the value of play? If you're listening on the podcast, this is a good moment to hit pause and do a little reflecting before you go on. We just got back from some time away in the mountains of BC with a couple of our adult kids, and one of the places where we spent some time on this trip was in an area that we visited often when our kids were smaller because it offered the sort of variety of mountain biking you need if you want to get everybody out riding, but you're dealing with everything from, in our case, a budding downhiller complete with, you know, full face helmet and body armor and this big burly bike to a relatively little cyclist who's just starting to deal with the work of propelling themselves uphill, never mind controlling themselves going down. One of the things that we did on this trip was we took a couple of evening strolls through a campground where we usually stayed when we traveled with everybody, noting in particular the sites we preferred and some of the extra activities, and all of that kind of good remember when stuff. It was quite delightful. We tended to prefer campsites in this particular location that backed onto the forest. And when we were talking about that and why we preferred that and what some of the challenges were, like you don't want it to back onto a forest, but you don't want it to back onto a cliff into the forest, right? And when we were talking about all of that, Taya made the observation that one of the things she loved when she thinks back on those days was all the made-up games that just happened in that environment and the surrounding forest. And what I remember, among other things, is absolutely filthy kids being bundled off to the camp washrooms at the end of the day, returning in their jammies, just happily exhausted and ready to call it a day. We still tend to aim at ending the day happily exhausted and kind of grubby, but the play is a little bit more intentional. It's a bit more focused. That's good. I wouldn't trade it. And sometimes I also find myself feeling just a little bit wistful about being at least a close-up witness to the childhood version of play with no agenda. And it seems to me that true leisure, free time, play without an agenda, rest, whatever we want to call it, seems to me from a few years down the road from there, it's not an either-or to work so much as it's like a pretty dynamic balancing act. And somewhere in that balancing act, I think we have the opportunity to fuse or blend together two things that might initially seem like they're opposites or enemies with one another, and in that process to unlock something I think potentially quite beautiful and really important.
So let me put that idea this way. What if at the intersection of leisure and intentionality, there exists the possibility of leisure becoming a spiritual practice, one that has the potential to achieve many good things, but among them to reconnect us to one another as humans, to reconnect us or connect us more deeply to the greater rhythms of life, and to help us connect to whatever we call the mystery that's beyond what we can see. If that's even a reasonable thought, what might keep us from pursuing it further? I'm not going to get into the things that get in the way in this particular talkie bit. There's a whole realm to explore there, but I'll just leave that as a question to the side. We've often spoken here about the importance and the power of culture. I heard somebody observe recently, an Indigenous thinker observe recently, that one of the reasons lots of folks who are part of the dominant culture don't talk about the importance of culture is because they never think about culture, because their experience is they are it. It's not an external to them. That's not the case here. We've often talked about culture as a thing in itself. What I like to define as the way things are around here is sort of a short definition for culture, both in our own personal spheres of influence and in the wider world around us. And that wider cultural framework often includes assumptions about leisure, some of which might have come to mind as you considered those and as we talked about those initial questions about what we remember from our own formative experiences around this. Many of us grew up surrounded by the notions that leisure was either laziness or distraction or a luxury. Now, again, I don't want to turn those things into binaries because, for example, that leisure is a luxury does not necessarily mean that it's a bad thing, right? But taken to an extreme or functioning in a way that has an enmity or a resistance to also doing work in a meaningful way. Those ideas can behave lots of different ways. Some of us, maybe most of us, grew up swimming, I would say culturally, in the idea that we are what we produce and that our value as persons is measured either by our outputs or by the things that we can buy with our outputs. And I think a lot of this is unconscious. It's so pervasive. Either way, many of us have grown up surrounded by a framework for understanding ourselves to have value as long as we're productive. We justify our leisure with productivity. We've talked about that already this morning in our group conversation, right? I can rest with a clear conscience because I got the things on my list done. That's still that same framework. Better than I can never rest, but right, those things are still talking to one another. And also in that framework, many of us have experienced, again, consciously or subconsciously, that we have diminishing or even vanishing value when we make less widgets, when we're less productive, whatever shape that might take. And lots of folks as they age talk about this as well, right? Becoming invisible. Well, there's a link between that sense of invisibility and this notion that we have value because we're productive. Now, we might not care for that as a dominant narrative. We might even argue that it's got some problems. But if we look at that critically and we see something wrong with it, what are the options? On our longish drive back from the mountains, Taya and I were talking about how hard it can be for young adults in general, for her as a young adult these days, kind of looking down the barrel of a question like, how do I make a living in this economy and still have a life? So that's not about not liking your work, something which Taya really does. She really quite enjoys what she's doing for work. But also, it can feel like if I'm actually ever going to pay the bills, I won't be able to do anything but work. That's the economic reality I'm facing. That's sort of that perception, right? So that's a big challenge. And that got me thinking, what if there is what we might call sort of a spiritual counter-narrative to that? Again, balance. What happens if we start to consider leisure as something like spaciousness? Or delight, or something that increases our capacity to be present, both to what is in us, what is around us, and what is beyond us. What if leisure opens into those things? Not that long ago, we spent a bit of time in this space reflecting on some of the work and life of Julian of Norwich. And for those that weren't present to that, or for those that might benefit from a reminder, Julian gave us lots of important spiritual insights, including this idea that all shall be well, which came up in another way in our conversation as a group this morning. That idea came to her in a series of visions, and those were made possible by the fact that she had chosen a life of contemplation, a life that from our contemporary point of view might look a lot like a life in which someone spends most of their day doing something that we might consider unproductive. They're not making a widget at all. And here we are a long time later, still mining the wisdom that came from that choice. In the Christian tradition, there's also this idea that's found in some of the earliest poems that muse about the nature of God as creator, in which God chooses to stop working. The Hebrews called it in English Sabbath, which means stop. Not because God was exhausted, but because they were fulfilled. And they wanted to stand back from the work to just enjoy the goodness of what was around them. Meaningful work, deliberate leisure. And some of the oldest narratives that we've given shape to as storytellers. If we wanted to reference a more contemporary contemplative, Thomas Merton contended that the soul needs time to be still and to waste time, he said, on purpose. He used that phrase, waste time on purpose. Interesting kind of collision, even language-wise, right? If Mr. Merton was here, I might say, on what purpose, Thomas? And he would say, I expect, contemplation. That would be the obvious answer. But he would also say that for the soul to be well, and this, of course, implies that we're thinking of ourselves as humans, as beings with bodies, minds, and spirits, or souls, he would say that one of the purposes is also mystery, because to be well, we need some mystery. We've talked about that together already today as a group, right? What would our life have been like if it went this way instead of that way? What do we make of these signs and symbols and encounters that we have in the world? That's mystery. And also, Merton would say, creativity. That for the soul to be well, we need to make space for creativity. Another thing that helped the miles go by on that trip was listening to Taya work on learning new songs for her summer job, which is as a musician working with artists in healthcare. So basically her job is that she works in healthcare facilities making music for and with the residents, and she's having a quite delightful and meaningful experience with that. That means, among other things, that Taya needs to know a lot of songs that older folks know and love, which is not necessarily her default repertoire, right? So she texted me the other day. We were counting songs in her list as we were kind of driving, and she was adding new ones, and she's like, it's over 50 at this point, you know, like that she can just sing. When somebody's like, do you know that one? She's like, yep. And so she's got this crazy repertoire. It's a bit of an eclectic collection. The one she was working on the drive that sort of slots in here, some of you might know this Creedence Clearwater Revival tune called Looking Out My Back Door. And I'll sing you a little bit of it just for fun because I think you'll recognize the hook. Stay with me. I'm illustrating something. This isn't just self-indulgence. But the song starts out, just got home from Illinois, locked the front door, oh boy, got to sit down, take a rest on the porch. Imagination sets in. Pretty soon I'm singing, do, 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 looking out my back door. Tell me you don't know that one. Okay, nods all around the room, right? Yeah, so that's the hook right there. There's a giant doing cartwheels, a statue wearing high heels. Look at all the happy creatures dancing on the lawn. Dinosaur Victrola listening to Buck Owens. Do, 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 looking out my back door. And then the chorus, which probably some of us will recognize this, right? Tambourines and elephants all playing in the band. Won't you take a ride on a flying spoon? Do, do, do. Wondrous apparition provided by a magician. Do, 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 looking out my back door. And then he repeats that. Tambourines and elephants are playing in the band. Won't you take a ride on the flying spoon? Do-do-do. Bother me tomorrow. Today I'll buy no sorrows. Do-do-do. Looking out my back door. Woo! Like, if that doesn't make you grin, check your batteries, okay? Like, aside from the great hook, what a great song. It's just bursting with imagination. Well, so here's the thing. Taya started learning this one. And if this helps you to picture it, I'm driving, Taya's sitting in the passenger seat, and we have a travel guitar, like this little guitar that she had along because she was working on tunes. So she's sitting like beside me playing guitar and learning this song while we're driving. So just that's, you know, kind of fun. But she starts learning this, and I'd never really paid attention to the verse lyrics. Do, 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 looking on my way, good enough, right? Like, I got the hook. She starts going through these lyrics, and my first take was, these have got to be the direct result of something that the songwriter snorted, right? Like, it's so trippy. Like, tambourines and elephants all playing in the band, all the happy creatures dancing on the lawn. I'm like, sitting on your porch, dude. Like, what else is happening in this story that you're not talking about? Which doesn't necessarily make it a less enjoyable song. But that's not actually the case. That's not the story. John Fogerty, the songwriter, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, still out there touring, he says, that the song Looking Out My Back Door was inspired by Dr. Seuss's book, and to think I saw it on Mulberry Street. And he wrote the song for his three-year-old son, Josh, after reading the book to Josh repeatedly. And the whimsical imagery in the song, including that parade passing by and the strange creatures, is meant to mirror the imaginative world of the Dr. Seuss story. Fogarty's intention as a songwriter was to try to capture the joy and the fantasy of his three-year-old son's world. That sounds a lot like Lack of Utility to me. And that song is still making people happy today. Right? Interesting intersection. I think this is a question for each of us to answer for ourselves, but when I look at my own life and the lives of so many people around me, I feel like modern life is much more characterized by restlessness than by peace. On my most generous day, I can't find it in me to characterize the world that I live in as a peaceful one. And we could argue that being busy is not working. We specialize in distraction, but being distracted is very, very different from being at peace, don't you think? Again, not a new idea. Well-known author, Henry David Thoreau, part of his one-year experiment in living, as he called it, where he built a little cabin with his own hands and lived there for a year. And as a sort of a reflective engagement, he wrote, "It is not enough to be busy. The question is, what are we busy about?" It's worth noting that Thoreau's life wasn't an instance of extreme isolation or contemplation. He could see a train track. You can go to the site of his cabin today. He could see a train track across the lake from his front porch. He could easily walk the mile into town for supplies. He could pretty much as easily go to his family home to access resources and interact with other people. It wasn't a strict ascetic engagement with contemplation. And that's led some people to dismiss his reflections on the value of solitude and contemplation. But when I think about how difficult it can feel to me to carve out a couple of minutes to just be still, which, by the way, little advertisement here, if you will, but I think this is part of the gift that the table offers to those who engage with this community, is just that moment that we take every time we're together to just be still. It's hard to do that. It's hard to make that happen. When I think about how challenging it can be, it seems like maybe those very circumstances in Thoreau's life inform his reflections in ways that might help us more creatively look for opportunities to be intentional about making time for our own intentional, purposeful leisure. Purposeful leisure is not, that's not a meeting of antonyms. That's not opposites. When I was first working on this talkie bit, I thought about calling it something like the sacred art of rest. And I didn't go down that route, partly because I felt like the word sacred might, you know, labor under a cloud of its own history in ways that are off-putting. Now, this could just be a me thing. When I was first starting my college studies, the program I was enrolled in was a Bachelor of Sacred Music degree. I knew I loved making music. The institution I was most familiar with offered that as their music degree. This sounds fully irresponsible now, but it's true. I registered for and started my studies in that program without ever reading the academic catalog's description of it. Once I got a year or so into it, and I was like, this isn't fitting me real well. I did that. I went and read the description, and that cleared things right up. It described the program right there in front of me as a terminal program, meaning I realize now a program not designed as the foundation for further academic study or preparation, that prepared the graduate for work leading music programs in the context of a church. As Google would say, I rerouted. But in that context, as in many contexts, the word sacred points us toward religious. And if you look up the word sacred, this is the first thing you find. You'll find a definition like this: connected with God or the gods, or dedicated to a religious purpose, and so, because of that purpose, and so deserving veneration. Okay, that's a pretty fascinating linkage right there. This deserves to be venerated because it's connected to a religion. Like, that's an interesting thing. As an example sentence or phrase is sacred rites, okay? Second definition in this particular context was religious rather than secular. And the example phrase, so help me, I didn't know this when I decided which story I was going to tell to introduce it. The example phrase is sacred music. Had an interviewer from CBC call me one time because someone I was working with had won a Juno in the contemporary Christian music category, the Junos, and they asked me what made music Christian. And I said, if you're a plumber... Like, what makes your plumbing Christian, right? Music is music. Anyway, the poor interviewer, they weren't sure what to do. I think I just made this story a little too big for that 5 minutes. What makes something sacred is sort of the question, isn't it? For our purposes here at the table, I wanted an idea that cast a wider net than that. I wanted an idea that was big enough to embrace religion, but not be so constrained by it than the sort of stereotypical idea of sacred is. If we want to associate sacred with rest, or even better, sacred with play, I think we need a more generous notion of sacred, don't we? If we step away from the classic reference material, and we can just do this, you can just look it up, and we look up a more contemporary source, so a more contemporary definition, dictionary, we find that the word sacred can just as readily mean anything that is simply worthy of awe and respect. Which leads to a completely different question for me, but an interesting one. Does religion cease to be sacred when it ceases to behave in ways that are worthy of awe and respect? And I would contend that, in terms of how we use the language, it ceases to be sacred. It can be profane, in fact, if I wanted to choose an antonym. Now, let's just take that idea, that something sacred can be anything that is simply worthy of awe and respect, and think about, for a minute, about watching a child completely absorbed in imaginative play. Just think about that. Just picture that for a moment. It's almost otherworldly, isn't it? Like there's a bubble around that. It is, in the fullest sense, awesome. It's sacred. Not because it's religious, but because if we attend to it, it captivates us, it draws us into a world that isn't so easily seen, it commands our attention, it even invites us to join. The price of admission, if you've ever tried to join a child in fully imaginative play, is letting go of our preconceived notions of what matters, even what is real, and letting our imaginations enter a space that we didn't make and that we don't control. In Celtic spirituality, which almost always had a hearty dose of mysticism stirred into the mix, creation was a dance. I think the Celts read the Genesis poems with a bit more imagination than those who initially taught me did. That whole, you know, God spoke and things happened reading, I mean, it's there in the words, I get that. But the emphasis kind of that I grew up on kind of reeks of contemporary power dynamics, right? Along the lines of, you know, someone's a big deal when they can just speak and things happen. That's how you know they're powerful. Which takes us right back to I am what I produce, doesn't it? But if you've ever had a chance to work with a group of, in particular in my experience, of movement-oriented artists in the collaborative creation of something, you know that once some trust is established, and that takes some work, and you start to move together, things emerge. Ideas show up. And they don't come from nowhere, although sometimes it can feel like they do, but they can come as a surprise, and they often require, if we're going to continue to collaborate, that we put aside our own preferences or preconceptions to be part of joining something greater. Right there, that process can get stuck if we're like, that's not how it works for me. If we're familiar with some of the Christian mythologies about creation, what happens if we choose to read them through the lens of creation as an act of joy rather than an act of efficiency? Well, one of the first results may well be that we cease to wrestle with reconciling them to contemporary science. Like if we stop reading the creation narratives with the lens of efficiency, we just stop worrying about whether the days are literal. Like for, you know, it's irrelevant. To me, when I was thinking about this, it seems to me it's kind of like if you go to see a dance performance and you find yourself sitting there trying to calculate the physics of what you're watching, you're probably going to miss the story. It's just the wrong frame. When we consider the possibilities of leisure as sacred, we're trying to imagine free time. If that doesn't bend our mind, we should just spend a few moments with that idea, free time. We're trying to imagine free time that connects us to the joy of being and not just doing, which is not to say there is not joy in doing. We're looking for balance here. All right, that's a lot of ideas. So let's get practical for just a couple minutes, and then I'll wrap this up. What might something we think of as spiritual leisure look like in our lives? What sorts of choices lend themselves to spiritually purposeful free time and have that not be a collision. And again, this is going to look really different for each of us, but examples could include things like walking in a forest really matters here for all kinds of reasons I won't take the time to get into, but there are things about our brains and how a forest is, among other things, that intersect in ways that really open us up, or a less developed setting, whatever that looks like. Art making, of course, can land in a space like this. Slow food can be in a space like this pretty readily. Unstructured time, creative play, all those kinds of things. For some, the idea of stopping as a spiritual discipline is helpful. That ancient idea of Sabbath coming back in forms that we choose rather than forms that are dictated to us by religious institutions or structures. Sometimes we find the dictation or the reinforcement of those structures helpful as well, right? So there's nothing wrong with showing up for an hour on Sunday to be part of a structured thing if that helps us stop. That's different than a structure that says, if you don't show up for that hour, God's pissed at you. It's not the structure is not the enemy. It's what we do with the structure that can get us into hot water. We did a whole series a few months ago exploring ideas about rest as resistance, deliberately stopping as a way of saying to the forces in our surrounding culture, in particular those associated with capitalism, which can commodify us as human beings, as labor. So rest as resistance can be a way of saying you can have some of my time, but you can't have me, which is a really important distinction. If that's something that intrigues you and it's a new idea, there's podcasts about those explorations in our online archive as well. And since the table is all about exploring, let me offer a couple of questions, and that's how I'll end, that might inform any further kind of poking around that we want to do in this. So we could think of these as questions to guide our leisure. If we're thinking, what sort of leisure is this in my life? Questions like, does this nourish my soul? Does this nourish my spirit? Does this choice, this leisure, this use of free time, does this open space for being present or for experiencing things like gratitude? Does this open into that? Is this about being and not, again, with the qualifiers that we've mentioned, not just doing? I don't know that I'm unique in this regard, but I've certainly turned more than one hobby into a business in my life. And those things behave differently in those two different settings. Is this about being and not just doing? And then let me leave us with this one as just kind of a summary question. If we think about what is both mysterious and compelling to us as what we might call spirit, the question could be this. Where in my life, in your life, in our life, might spirit be inviting us to slow down, to delight, or to waste time beautifully? And then if we wanted to sort of practice this in a simple way, we could just stop whatever we're doing and think about it. Peace.